And before maybe you run away, I could say that an alternative title for tonight's talk could be parenting. This week I fantasized about making a street sign. You know, these yellow signs, the diamond signs, and it says yield to whatever. I thought we could have a sign that said yield to the present. It might be very useful. The Buddha emphasized the usefulness of living in the present moment, as I think most of you know. And there's a somewhat famous quote from the Buddha where he says, "Do not regret the past. Do not speculate about the future. Live fully in the present by seeing things as they really are. Don't get stuck in the past. Don't get stuck in thinking about the future. But find yourself living fully, mindfully, this life that's unfolding in the moment right now." And this is something that in Buddhism we consider to be very useful, to live in the present, to cultivate the ability to stay present. And there's a number of reasons why it's very valuable to cultivate this ability to stay in the present. I might mention first that the present, the lived present, the present that we live in and experience consciously, is the only place where we'll experience some of the beautiful aspects of being alive. This is where certainly we can feel our aliveness, we can feel joy, we can feel connectedness or tenderness or compassion or love for others, or receive it from other people and from them, when we're in the present moment. We can't receive those things or offer those things to the world and people around us if we're stuck or thinking about the past or involved in memories or fantasies, or if we're thinking about the future. I don't think the two coexist so much. That the real feeling of the kind of joy and delight and is only experienced when you can be present for it in the present moment as it's occurring. So for those of us who feel that experiencing these wonderful parts of life, joy, connectedness to others, love, are valuable, the ability to stay in the present then increases the possibility of experiencing those things. And I know from my own experience that if I get caught up in my preoccupations, that there's often very little room for me to experience joy or love or tenderness. Another value of being present is that the present moment is the only place where our clinging or our resistance to life really occurs. And these things are the source or the root of stress, which is a major theme for many people. Now, the Buddhist teachings say that the root of stress or suffering has to do with something you're doing in the present moment. It might have its history, it might extend back in time, its history or its causal conditions and all that, but it's not the past is not causing your suffering now. It's something you're doing in the present moment which is causing your suffering now. So the value of being present is also to start seeing very carefully the causes and conditions in the present moment that cause stress, cause resistance and addiction and clinging and these things. And we say in Buddhism it's very valuable to become aware of these things, because it's only by becoming aware of where our resistance is and where our attachments are that we see the possibility of finding a life that doesn't offer resistance or doesn't offer clinging, a life that is free, liberated, as we say. So Buddhism is an antidote to stress and suffering, to the kind of stress and suffering that comes from clinging and resistance. And as an antidote, and it leads to freedom. And freedom itself, liberation itself, is also found in the present moment. We need to be present in order to be free, to experience our liberation. And you find sometimes in the way Buddhist teachers sometimes talk about liberation is they kind of slide back and forth between talking about it as a state of mind towards talking about some wonderful, in some wonderful celebratory way, the qualities of the present moment itself. They talk about the present moment being timeless. And I like the word timeless because it implies kind of a boundlessness, it's limitlessness of the present moment. Sometimes they, as Buddhist teachers, will point towards to the sky. And so an open, kind of clear blue sky has a kind of quality of limitlessness or boundlessness or spaciousness or openness that sometimes resonates for people with the possibility of the same kind of feelings of openness or spaciousness or freedom of the mind. And so the present moment sometimes is celebrated as this wonderful place because the present moment itself is not outside of our constricted world of resistance or clinging. The present moment itself is actually always quite non-resisting or quite spacious. So freedom is found in the present moment. Now freedom is something which I think, well, in our country, in America, it's a high value, the pursuit of life, liberty, and freedom, life, liberty, and happiness. Life, liberty, and happiness. And but you know, what does liberation mean? What does it mean to be liberated, to be free? Sometimes people take it to be free to get whatever you want, and acquisitions. The freedom to acquire is something which a lot of people want. Maybe the younger we are, perhaps the more that's the case. I see it in my little 7-month son, the tremendous drive to acquire, to have, you know, and a tremendous protest that can happen when he doesn't get what he wants. And I suspect that this is a very healthy thing in young babies, this drive to acquire, because it's how you learn about life. But some of us continue with the drive well beyond its usefulness. But freedom itself does not, the freedom that Buddhism talks about does not involve any kind of acquisition. It's not an attaining something or acquiring something. It's also not an avoidance of anything in a sense. It's not acquiring things, it's not acquiring experiences, and not acquiring people or acquiring relationships. It doesn't require anything that we get, but rather freedom belongs more to the way in which we relate to all the things of the world. It's kind of like the way we hold our experiences of the world. So freedom doesn't apply to the experiences of the world, but rather the way we hold all those, we can say in a sense. And can we hold it with some spaciousness, with some awareness? I find it a tremendous benefit to me personally to have a regular sitting practice, to come and meditate. And I saw it very much this last week when it was quite worrisome for me, the situation with my family and the accident and all these feelings of concern that I had. And I didn't necessarily feel that my concerns were inappropriate, but I could feel how I got constricted around them, and that my meditation practice allowed me to have those still and take responsibility for them, but allowed me to kind of experience them with a lot of room around them. Again, you know, like it's occurring in a vast open sky. And so the suffering of being constricted around them wasn't so present. So the way in which we can hold things in this kind of, in the boundlessness of space or awareness. But this is not something we often relate to. We don't relate very well to something that seems as invisible as non-clinging or non-resistance. The open, boundless nature of stuff, you can't exactly grab the sky, right? So you get kind of tired of it after a while. It's much more, seems much more tempting to grab things or people or whatever. And that's what many people do, is they expect things or experiences or some particular kind of relationship with some person to be the magic that's going to really make them happy or free. And these things can lead to some kind of pleasure, or sometimes to happiness, but not the profound liberating happiness or that is talked about in Buddhism. This kind of freedom that's a possibility of each of us needs no thing. In the present moment, we can find the wonderful treasure of being alive and content with nothing. It's possible to be alive and content with nothing. I don't know if this fits, but the other night, our son kind of sleeps with us. He has a little futon next to our futon, and we sleep on the floor now because we don't want him to fall off the bed. So he's sleeping on the floor there, you know. And he can crawl about now. And so he doesn't know about that's your bed. So I think my wife went to the bathroom middle of the night, and she came back, and our son had taken her place. And, you know, and she needs to sleep next to him because she can provide things I can't do. So the solution to this was that I slept on the floor. And we have a couch. We have a carpet that's, you know, a little bit thick. So I put my pillow there and put the blanket over, and I was there. And it reminded me, sleeping there, about the wonderful delight and joy of a simple life that I've experienced much of my life, especially when I was living as a monastic, that, you know, I don't really need a mattress. I'm actually quite comfortable on the carpet. And it's a lot more comfortable on the carpet than the beds they gave us in Burma in the monastery, which were just, hard wooden planks with kind of, you know, these straw tatami mats, these straw mats on top. And so I actually thought it was kind of like, oh, sometimes I'm afraid that I shouldn't talk too much about myself here. Traditionally in Buddhism, one of the traditions in Buddhism is that the teachers don't talk about themselves at all. But in America, Dharma teachers think that it's useful to tell a lot of personal stories because then people relate to what you're saying more. So I don't know what to do. Doing fine. So I came back from my long stint in one of my years in Asia, where I lived like this on tatami mats or on wood mats or whatever in monasteries, and I came back to the San Francisco Zen Center where I'd been a student and I knew people really well. And so I came back there they wanted to, you know, in the first days I was back, they were kind of treating me as a guest, this kind of, in a kind of honorable way or something. So they put me in the guest house they had, and they put me in one of the beds in the guest house. And it was just phenomenally, you know, mattresses. It was just really soft, and this big quilt. And I looked at that, and I couldn't get myself to sleep on it. And so there was a throw rug on the floor, so I just slept there. And I was quite content. So when I slept on the floor the other night, next to my wife, but on the floor, I was really happy that way and was reminded of the great happiness of a simple life and how little we need. And how, you know, it's a lot easier, you know, to make your bed then and to move and all kinds of things. And I was a little bit nostalgic. So we need very little, actually. And it doesn't mean we have to give away anything or give up anything that we have. But our freedom itself doesn't need anything. The great happiness of freedom doesn't need anything. And when we realize that, then maybe we have a different relationship both to both the things we have, but also a different relationship to the priorities we have in our life. Because many people's priorities are tied up with things or people or getting things. And it's a whole different way of living a life when priorities have to do with freedom, which doesn't a freedom which doesn't require anything, but rather a kind of openness, non-resistance to life itself. So the question is, how do we live in the present moment if the present has all these great values? I think first we learn to live in the present moment by finding value and satisfaction in doing so. And if you don't find some kind of value or some kind of satisfaction in living in the present moment, then it's going to be very hard to be motivated to do so. And so I suggest to any of you, if you don't really feel that there's some satisfaction or some value, and the two aren't necessarily the same, in being in the present and cultivating the ability to be mindful of what happens in your life as you stay present, then you might want to reflect deeply about this issue, or come and talk to me, or talk to some other teacher, or talk to some friends about what is it that you find of value, or what is it you find satisfactory about being in the present? And if you find something like that, then it's a lot easier, I think, to want to do that than actually do it. A second way of cultivating our ability to be in the present is by the dual practices of mindfulness and renunciation, mindfulness and letting go. And these two work together, because there's a way in which, as we bring our mindfulness to clearly see what's happening in the present moment, that either because by our doing or by the nature of things themselves, there tends to be a letting go that happens. Sometimes we see very clearly where our clinging is, and we see we have an option of whether to cling or not, to resist or not, and we can decide to let go. Or even more profoundly, if you bring enough very careful attention to what's happening in the present moment, you'll find you don't have to do any doing. You don't have to do the letting go. But the letting go will happen in the nature of life itself. The letting go will happen naturally with enough clear, resistant mindfulness of what's happening. It's a phenomenal thing. Sometimes I call this a self-liberating aspect of reality. That reality wants to free itself if we allow it to. And the way we can allow it to do is to bring very careful mindfulness to what's actually happening in the present. So letting go and mindfulness happen together, and the two reinforce each other. In my teaching of this kind of practice, I tend to emphasize mindfulness much more than renunciation or letting go. I think probably you all know. And in a moment I'll kind of explain why. I just want to mention that renunciation has many synonyms. Maybe it helps you kind of get a hang of the word. It can mean letting go. It can mean surrender. It can mean release, the release of our life, release of our clinging, of our resentment. Someone said the cost of freedom, in order to become free, you have to let go, you have to give up your resentment. But what renunciation is not resignation. And I think part of the confusion and part of the resistance people have to the word renunciation is it can sound like resignation, giving up in it rather than letting go, kind of resigning ourselves to our fate in a way that's actually kind of depressing. So renunciation is often underappreciated by many people, I think especially in our culture, when we don't talk about it so much. Its function is not to lose something as much as the gaining of the present and the possibility available in the present. And I spend all the time in the beginning talking about the value of being present and what's possible to discover for oneself when one cultivates the present moment. And so renunciation is one way of finding that all that value that's found in the practice, all the value that's found. So rather than thinking of it losing something, you can think of it as gaining something really precious. We gain a conscious life. We gain a life of kindness, of care, of compassion, of joy. I gave a talk on renunciation here a couple of years ago, and the impression I had at that time was that the talk didn't go over very well. And so it's taken me 2 years to muster up the courage and to sit here in front of you and... You know, I don't know why, but kind of somehow the sense I got was, you know, it didn't really, you know, maybe I didn't do a particularly good job on the talk, maybe that's why. But anyway, I didn't feel like it went anywhere. You know, people weren't so interested in the topic. And I hope we're doing better today. I gave the example at that time of renouncing my self-image when I went and visited Abhyagiri, the monastery, the Theravada monastery up in Ukiah, where Ajahnamurro is. There's a custom when you go to a monastery to visit the monks, especially if you show up in the morning, to come with food for the meal that day, because traditionally the monks don't eat unless the lay people come and offer them food. And so those of us who we went up in a big party, We all brought food for, you know, to make it as an offering. And I knew that all my friends who were going were doing that, and they were bringing prepared food. I also knew that the monks up there tend to get the most prepared food on the weekend when they get visitors. And during the weekday, they tend not to get so many visitors, And so they don't. The fare tends to be a little bit poorer then. They don't necessarily have enough food or to get through the week. I think they usually have enough, but I don't know, it's much simpler or whatever. So it occurred to me, well, I'm not going to give them prepared food for today. I'm going to buy lots of bags of potatoes and rice and can this and that and all the stuff they can store away and use during the week when they don't have visitors. Seemed like a good idea. So I did that. I came and brought all my bags and stuff and offered it to the kitchen. I was thanked for it. And my friends brought all their prepared food. And then the way the custom is up there is everybody eats together, lunch together. But first all the food is offered to the monks and they serve themselves. And then the food that's left over, which is usually abundant, then gets offered to the lay people who are also eating the same meal. But at the beginning, as each dish comes out, it's announced who that dish is a donation from. So here I was sitting, and all my friends around me, thank you, you know, they donated the tofu dish, they donated the salad, you know. And, you know, and I don't know how obvious it was to others, but I felt like I was this huge sore thumb sticking out, you know. I was the one person who obviously hadn't made a donation to that meal that day. And my strong sense of, you know, pride or ego or self-image, you know, I was going to scream out and say, but you know, you should know that I made this donation, you know, food for the rest of the week, you know, and, you know. But, you know, in a monastery where practice of renunciation and renouncing your self-image is such a, you know, strong value, I it didn't seem quite right to kind of yell out and look at me too. So I don't know how people saw me, and maybe they had all kinds of thoughts about me, about how, you know, greedy I was for not bringing anything or whatever, but I had to renounce whatever thoughts they had about me and what self-image I was concerned about, and just sit there with it all. And it felt quite appropriate to be in a monastery and renounce, see these things, these strong tendencies, and renounce them. And at that time, I also mentioned, I believe, why I don't talk much about letting go of renunciation. And I wanted to mention some of those reasons tonight and add to them. One is that when we let go of things too easily or too quickly, sometimes we don't understand the root tendency which brought about that clinging or that attachment or that resistance to begin with, that holding on or that whatever that we're letting go of. If we let go of our anger too quickly, and some practitioners get very good at letting go of anger, then we don't understand what stimulated the anger inside of us. For example, it could be a sense of hurt or a sense of fear inside of us. And if that sense of hurt lingers, the anger might, or feeling of insecurity lingers, then it might easily give birth again to anger in a few minutes or a few hours or a few days over and over again. And if we let go too easily, we won't study it deeply enough to see the roots. But if we allow the anger to be there in a respectful way, or whatever it is, then sometimes we can begin discerning the wider conditionality of it and see some of the roots. And as we see things more deeply, then the healthy unfoldment of the Dharma, of our practice, and the liberation will happen in its own. So that's one reason. Another reason is that we sometimes confuse renouncing things, money, sex, possessions, with a life of freedom. And again, freedom itself doesn't belong to the world of things itself, either acquiring them or rejecting them. And so, but some spiritual people think that only if I don't have these things, if I give up all these things, then I'll be spiritual, I'll be doing the right thing. And it can be a tremendous misplacement of spirituality or Buddhist practice, is to think the practice is in giving up things that we have. Some people want to give up things, and it's actually sometimes a quite beautiful and appropriate thing. When people, I've known people who've given everything away they had and gone off to a monastery or gone off to live a life of a practitioner somewhere, and it felt very much the right thing to do for them. And tremendous joy and blessings come from that kind of life of simplicity. But it can also be done with tremendous amount of ego and a tremendous amount of misunderstanding when we let go of things inappropriately. So because of that confusion, sometimes I don't talk about this practice of letting go. Letting go or renunciation can also be a form of aversion. It's a turning away from the present, turning away from some part of ourselves that we don't like, or some part of life we don't like. So we, you know, split. So, for example, the monk who talked about, you know, the joys of renouncing the world, because the householder life of working and shopping and cleaning dishes is just so cumbersome, you know, and gets in the way and all that. And so you renounce all those things so you can live a simple life and really practice. And that's maybe nice, but there's a different kind of renunciation where you renounce yourself to washing the dishes. And you really fully enter it fully as the practice itself. You don't have to see it being separate from practice. So if the turning away is out of aversion, I think actually creates bad habits. And the fourth and final reason why I haven't talked about it so much, letting go, renunciation, is that as a conscious kind of practice that I've taken on, I haven't taken on renunciation and letting go as a big practice for myself. There are times when it's been very, very important for me, but overall in the many years of my practice, it hasn't been a very important theme. And so maybe then I shouldn't talk about it very much. And that maybe sounds a little bit strange for someone who lived as a monk for many years. You know, renunciation is not important. I mean, that's what a monk's life is like. And the reason is that I was always inspired to move towards something. And so the letting go of things and possessions or whatever, a regular life, that life involved, the monastic life involved, I never was considering, and it was never, I never even considered what I was leaving behind, because I was always thinking about what was ahead, in a sense. The joy and the possibility of freedom was so clear to me that it just seemed so obvious that this is the direction to go, so much richer life than a life of having a lot of things and pursuing that. And so, because of that, I think you understand. I'm repeating myself now. You know, so the renunciation wasn't so important. I wanted to live a monastic life, and so that kind of renunciation was easy. Was too easy to qualify. Renunciation in that sense was too easy to qualify as a practice that I really did. Now, parenting has pushed renunciation to the forefront of my life. So, and I'm finding that for me personally, that it's much more demanding and difficult and challenging for me to be a parent than it ever was to be a monk. And maybe it's different for different people, but that is in my situation. And what happens with parenting is that I have to renounce all kinds of things all the time. And oftentimes, I don't feel like I have a choice but to do that. It isn't that I can say, well, you know, it's fine, you know, rather than renounce, why don't you just bring a lot of mindfulness to this and really study and get to know it really well? You know, the kid's screaming, you know, crying, you know, and he needs something, you know. So I don't have the luxury to kind of hold on to my clinging, you know, and study it really well and get to know my clinging really well. I just have to let go and deal with the kid, you know. And so I have to renounce my sleep, my wakefulness, my clarity. I have to renounce my work, many of the things I do that I'm used to doing, projects, writing things, preparing Dharma talks, talking to practitioners, answering phone calls. It's almost I can't do most of them. I can't do anymore, and it surprises me that because I can't do them. These things that I'm so used to doing. One of the benefits of this is I see, as long as I could do them easily, I couldn't see very clearly how I was maybe attached to these things, or how tied to my self-image in various ways. It was kind of invisible to me. But suddenly, when I can't do these things because of the demand of parenting, I see this much more clearly than I did before. And sometimes I find my little ego saying, "Hey, wait a minute! You know, what about this and what about that?" And I feel my attachments much more. I feel how I'm driven at times. I feel, you know, I come and give a Dharma talk, and there's no time to prepare. And then I, you know, I see my concern about, you know, I'm going to do a lousy job. And so I see that, but you know, if I have plenty of time to prepare, then I'm not thinking about that. I'm just kind of preparing, right? So over and over and over again, because of the tremendous demands that parenting has on, at least on me, I see myself in a way that I maybe haven't seen myself. It's rarely that I've seen myself so intensely, and been challenged so in such a concentrated way, in such a short time. And some of the things are easy to let go of, and some of the things are not so easy to let go of or to renounce. It was interesting that after the accident, I renounced everything. It was very clear. There was no question. You know, I just dropped what I was doing. I was teaching a retreat up at Jokoji, and I was told about the accident. And I think it took me 2 minutes to leave the place. It was clear that I just had to go to the hospital. And for the next days, it was very clear what I had to do. And in some ways, it was very easy to renounce, to really be there for that event. But then as my wife started getting better, and then my other desires and wishes and all the long list of phone calls I had to answer started to nag at me. And I could feel this tension. And one of the things I had to renounce was my sense of responsibility, which I'm I tend to be overly driven by a sense of responsibility. Maybe not dramatically, but I'm driven by it a little bit. And responsibility is a lot different than taking good care of things, of what's in front of you, what needs to be done next. And so I felt bad about myself. You know, these people are upset. They don't know why I'm not calling them back. It's not the responsible thing to do. And it actually caused suffering for me, this issue. And I had to kind of, in a sense, give up even my sense of responsibility, because it was not possible for me to do the things I usually feel responsible things to do. So it doesn't bode very well for my self-image. I mean, that also, you know, boy, who's this guy Gil? He, you know, I called him 3 times and he doesn't call me back, and he doesn't respect me. And people call and I answer and I say, "I can't talk to you, bye." What do they think? So renunciation, giving up. So much, you know, even our ability to help. You know, my son, after the accident, before we knew his collarbone was broken, we didn't know what was wrong. And at some point, he'd been at the hospital first, and they gave him a clean bill of health. And I guess they didn't check him out that carefully. But he came home, and after being home for some while, he started screaming, screeching inconsolably. And, there was a lot of renunciation that had to happen for me, just holding him and him crying into my ear. Teach me to care and not to care is the great line in T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. And I think it's a wonderful line for Buddhist practice, because the giving up of care and responsibility is a very important part of the practice, but we don't do it so we become uncaring. We teach me to care and not to care at the same time. Teach me how to really take care of this, what's in front of me, but not to be plagued by a sense of responsibility. And I reflect on this regularly. I look at my son, and sometimes I see him, and you know, I see a person there that's very different than me. And I don't know who this guy is and who he's going to become. I feel that as a parent that I'm very responsible for him, And at the same time, I feel like I'm not responsible. Both are true. So I'm going to do my darndest to try to take, you know, raise him well. But I'm not really, there's things I'm not responsible for. I don't know how he's going to turn out and the choices he's going to make and the things that are going to unfold and with his health or his behavior or whatever. And I can't take responsibility for all of it. So there has to be renunciation of responsibility for my own son. And that feels very difficult as a parent. But it seems like it's necessary, as some of you who are parents, I think, have to, you know, must have realized. And there's a potential in him of tremendous beauty that might unfold through his life, and joy. And I see the possibility of tremendous ugliness and tremendous sorrow as his life unfolds. And I don't know what route it's going to take, or what combination of them it's going to take. And some of it's outside of my control. So part of renunciation is renouncing control, which I believe is probably for most parents somewhat difficult thing to do, because we feel like we're so responsible. I'm struck that in AA, the first step of AA has to do, I think, with kind of renunciation. I think they don't say use the word, but I think the wording is, I realize out of control, but I realize that I have no control over my use of alcohol. Isn't that right, what they say? I'm powerless. That I'm powerless in relation to alcohol. There's something that happens that's very powerful. And AA calls itself a spiritual kind of movement. There's something very powerful that happens spiritually when we realize that we're actually not in control either. We kind of have to give up our sense of control of our situation. I think a lot of people have a lot of fear around the loss of control. And sometimes it's not until we reach rock bottom that we realize we have to kind of also give up our sense of power over the situation. And in that giving up of control, sometimes there's a kind of a release that happens, or an allowing of something different that happens that is quite beautiful and powerful. And I think in AA they call a sobriety, they call it a gift, don't they? Because you don't do it, but somehow you realize your powerlessness, and in that realization, in that release that happens, something else might happen also. And I've seen this over and over again in my own practice. When I've kind of come up against tremendous difficulties in my practice, it seemed overwhelming. It was only in giving up and abandoning my sense of control that the release happened, and some wonderful gift of liberation happened as a result. So this book of the study group is going to be talking about When Things Fall Apart. It's a great title. What do you do when things fall totally apart? And sometimes they do. So sometimes there's a very easy renunciation for the benefit of a greater good. So for example, the benefit of my baby, you know. But I think the kind of renunciation, Buddhist renunciation, can go much further than that. And when rightly understood, it helps us to enter this kind of spacious, luminous, sacred realm of the present. I mean, it isn't that we're renouncing an order for the benefit of someone else. We might still be helping the other person, but we renounce our resistance and our clinging to what's unfolding in the present moment. And so we can enter the present moment with a kind of openness or spaciousness that I referred to earlier. And you might remember that the word sacrifice doesn't mean like, you know, the corporate sacrifice. You're going to sacrifice your family life for the corporation, you know, and or your endless hour, 60-hour work week. It's a tremendous sacrifice to work. We use that word expression, but the word sacrifice in the Latin meaning of the word means to make sacred. And I see it myself in the renunciation I have to do with my family, the demands of it now with my kid, that there are times when that renunciation is sacred and times when it's not. And when it's not is when I renounce the situation and I go take care of him, but there's lingering feelings of resentment or frustration or resistance to what's going on or something. And that is not renunciation. In the Buddhist, in the deep sense of that leads to freedom. If there's lingering resentment or frustration, it's not renunciation. Renunciation is actually the renouncing of our resistance and our clinging, so that our state of mind, in a sense, is not contracted anymore. So to make sacred is to enter into this world where the mind itself is like the sky, where the mind itself is not contracted or tight or clinging. Mahatma Gandhi was asked once, how is it that you seem to work all the time? You work 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the time. And how is it you can manage that? Now you're in your 70s or 80s or wherever he was. And his answer was, oh, because I'm always at rest. So he was a tremendously effective man. And to say that he was, yes.
Paid a tremendous price.
His life.
Some people don't know, but one of his children became an alcoholic, one became a Muslim.
That's okay.
No, but what I'm pointing out is a lot of famous people, again, it's a different category, a lot of people devote a lot of their life to public life and don't spend enough time with their kids.
Right.
Have problems. As the mayor of L.A. had that problem.
Oh, it's very common. But I would beg you to consider is that maybe these are two different things. That I still believe him when he said, I'm always at rest. But while he was at rest, he maybe made some bad choices about how to conduct his life and what he included as part of it, maybe. I think hopefully part of a life that's liberated is a life or moves in the direction of liberation is one that really takes into account the life around us and doesn't compartmentalize it in any way. I'd rather not judge someone like Gandhi because of the particular historical situation he found himself in and the kind of choices he had to make. But anyway, the point I wanted to make was, you might say for Gandhi, maybe it's possible he knew very well the cost on his family.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a different kind of renunciation that was required by him because he saw the opportunity that he had historically for who he was. And, it was a trade-off, maybe. So, I'm almost done. I realize that I'm going over. There is no bartering with the kind of renunciation that brings freedom. There's no kind of bartering. If I give this up, that is for the benefit. Or I'll get this out of it. There's actually just you give up to discover the possibility of non-resistance for its own right. Renunciation allows for the sacred in our life. The contraction and resistance doesn't allow for it. Renouncing a responsibility does not mean not caring, but can we take care of what needs our attention without worry, contraction, or resistance? I think that's the great challenge of us, not to renounce our care for each other, but rather to do it, can we do it without contraction? And I could see it in myself, that in this crisis in my family, I could feel very clearly what it was like to get contracted around it. And I could see what it was like to take care of it without the contraction. I could see both. And perhaps often I'm taking care of it better when I'm not contracted, not worrying. Another kind of footnote. One of my first reactions when I heard about how the accident happened was I was furious at this other man who was speeding, racing up on Skyline, passing another car on the curb, and he plowed head on into my wife. So I was furious. And I didn't exactly feel that my sense of fury was exactly right, but I had no sense I should be censoring it either. I just allowed it to be there. But then I was inspired, and it kind of dissipated after a while, And now it's been replaced by actually concern for this man, because I've heard that he's in critical condition. His car flipped over and he has head injuries. So now I'm quite concerned for him. But I was inspired by my wife's reaction, because she had to go to the hospital in the same ambulance as him. And so she was in better condition. She was sitting in that kind of chair, and he was laying down with all the tubes and everything, oxygen or whatever. And she was angry with him too. And I didn't have any sense that she felt that, you know, she had to censor her anger. But she also didn't want to kind of leave it just at being angry. And so she wanted to somehow connect to him as a person, so she wouldn't just have just anger for him. So she asked him for his name, to know what his name was, to have some more, see him as a person, rather than this, you know, guy who did this terrible thing. And I was kind of inspired by that. Even though she was angry, not pushing away the anger, but she reached forward towards the guy anyway. It's kind of renouncing of anger, perhaps, but not giving it up. At some point in our life, life will require us to let go of everything. And maybe that's a cliche to say, but I think it's something is very important to say. That everything we cherish at some point will be taken away from us. And the opportunity exists is to discover that as things are taken away from us, or as life becomes different than what we want it to be, as it takes the courses that are not our choosing, there's the opportunity actually to discover the sacred in that. Not in the things themselves, but again, there's a possibility of the way in which we hold things, the way in which we relate to them. It's possible to make it sacred in our renunciation of resistance, clinging, attachments, fear, and all these things, resentment. In our